Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to this seminar on promoting positive mental health in a time of inequalities, an ethical dilemma, question mark, rhetorical question there. It's fantastic to see the amount of interest that there's been in this seminar this afternoon. I think it reflects the debate that's going on in Scotland at the moment about the whole issue of promoting mental health, how one goes about it, how one goes about it in a way that doesn't actually increase inequalities, and indeed what we know about the determinants of good mental health and whose responsibility it is to address those determinants in a way that produces positive, more equitable outcomes. So there are a lot of issues underlying those three lines, the title of our seminar today. My name's Carol Tannehill. I have the pleasure of being the director of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, and we're delighted to be co-hosting this seminar with the Journal for Public Mental Health and Lynn, who's really been the mastermind behind it all, the Scottish Development Centre for Mental Health, the National Programme for Mental Health and Wellbeing, and the Mental Health Foundation. So in itself, getting to this stage has been a collaboration. We have a slight change to the order of this afternoon's programme. Richard Wilkinson is going to speak first, and Corey Keyes, who is here, but his presentation isn't at the moment, is going to speak after the break, so I hope that doesn't cause anybody any difficulties, but we didn't want to wait any longer before getting started. Just, I think, my role by means of introduction is just to give you some thoughts for you to consider as you hear this afternoon's two presentations. And I'm just going to go through the focus of the seminar stage by stage, and we'll come back to a number of these points in discussion. So they're really just a framework for you to have in your mind as you hear what's been talked about. Promoting positive mental health is, arguably, about directing attention to the determinants of positive emotions. And if we accept that, it raises a number of issues. Firstly, what's the relative importance of different levels of determinants, ranging from determinants that lie within an individual's own control, right through to global determinants, determinants at the level of the structures of society, and more local determinants in relation to environment, social structure, and so on. Where does responsibility lie? Is this something that is the responsibility of individuals? Or, at the other extreme, is it something that is the responsibility of the state? Probably most of us would think it's a mixture of those two, but we need to, I think, consider where the balance lies between them. What is the place of negative emotions? Do they have a place in positive mental health? Is there something that having negative emotions and experiencing negative things does to enable us to flourish? Or is attention to negative emotions completely contrary to what we're trying to achieve in promoting positive mental health? And, of course, the ultimate question, what would be an appropriate policy response? So that's a first set of issues. But, of course, it's not even as simple as that, or it's even more complex than that, promoting positive mental health in a time of inequalities. And as soon as we bring in that part of the statement, we need to consider whether the determinants of inequalities in mental health are different to the determinants of mental health at a population level. In other words, do the influences on our mental health interact with other things, and do they play out differently across different parts of society? Another issue is to consider whether mental health promotion interventions might actually increase inequalities because they're the sort of activities that some people are better placed to respond to than others are. And we're very aware of that in health promotion more widely, that a number of our health promotion programmes are taken up by those who have got better coping skills or better education, better information, and therefore they increase inequalities. And there's a risk that that might happen also in our efforts to promote positive mental health. And if you do think that these issues about the determinants of mental health inequalities and the danger of mental health promotion increasing inequalities are serious risks. What does that do in terms of your views on what the appropriate policy response is? And then the rhetorical question at the end, is this an ethical dilemma for us all? And if we're going to consider that question, there are some things we need to think about. Is the promotion of positive mental health a legitimate area of activity? That would be a starting point for any ethical consideration. Is this something that we have a legitimacy in dealing with? And if so, who has that legitimacy? Is it a very personal thing, a private thing, or is it something that the state has a legitimate role in intervening in? Second ethical issue might be, is this a priority given finite resources? Or are there other things that are more important than promoting positive mental health? Is it an endeavour with scientific legitimacy? Is it something that we can be confident that there is some evidence base for, or way we can measure the effects that we're having? Or is this purely a creative gut feel sort of activity? Will it lead to a more equitable society, equity being one of our core ethical principles that we would normally apply in public health? And where does responsibility and accountability lie? Now, I want to return to these sorts of questions in the discussion session at the end of the afternoon, but it would be really helpful, I think, if you keep those sorts of issues in your mind as you listen to our two presentations today. So I'm delighted first to introduce Richard Wilkinson. Richard's name I know will be known to many of you. Richard is Professor of Social Epidemiology at the University of Nottingham, and his work has focused over many years on the impact of inequality in societies, and has focused particularly on the psychosocial risk factors caused by inequality. And recently, Richard's work has focused more on looking at mental health and mental health inequalities, and I think you're going to talk a bit about that today. So let's give a good Glasgow welcome to Richard Wilkinson.
I'll close it down and then I'll be able to see the desktop and open this
You're
one.
You're in Glasgow, I think.
Yes, I'm in Glasgow, that's right.
Okay, Richard, thanks.
I should warn you, I've already been given a note saying take as much time as you need. So you're in for a long haul, I'm sorry. Good. I'm glad not to do the session which is, I think, traditionally the sleepiest as time goes on. Well, as Carol said, I've worked on health inequalities for a long time in physical health rather than mental health, but I've got sort of slowly into things, into the psychosocial pathways that serve to connect physical health to the material conditions in which people live. And then from realizing that health was better in amongst the rich countries, in the more egalitarian rich countries, that is to say in the Nordic countries and Japan compared to Britain, Portugal, USA, seeing actually that that pattern wasn't confined just to health. It seems to run across a huge range of problems which have social gradients, and a lot of them are behavioural problems and so very clearly must have psychosocial underpinnings. And what I'm going to show you really says what powerful psychosocial effects the degree of inequality has. I'm going to talk a lot about income inequality. I regard it as a determinant and also an expression or measure of the scale of social stratification, of hierarchy, of social distances in society. So don't just think about income itself, although I do believe that material distances give rise to social distances as well. I think people often, well, increasingly impressed by the sort of contrast between the material success of modern societies and maybe their social failure. And gradually my impression is that the things that we've been working on related to inequality really suggest that what we're looking at is a way of improving the psychosocial well-being of whole societies. I think that's important because, we've come to the end of what economic growth can do for us. I should have got my little pointer out of my bag. This graph is GNP per capita. The dots are countries, rich and poor countries. And up the side, you've got life expectancy. And so you can see very clearly that amongst the poor countries, life expectancy rises very rapidly and then levels off. And there's even a suggestion that amongst the very rich countries, suggestion even of a decline as countries get increasingly rich. And that's not just longevity. If you look at happiness, this is Layard's data on happiness. These are the poor countries, and in the early stages of economic growth, happiness increases, and then it levels out. And we know that all those measures of welfare no longer increase with rises in GNP per capita. We also know that this is infant mortality in relation not to GNP per capita, but closely related to its energy use per capita. So as countries get richer and use more and more energy, their GNP per capita, their infant mortality falls very fast, but then we use more and more energy without getting much out of it. And it seems to me we're the first generation for thousands of years to have to think again about how do we improve the real subjective quality of our lives. You know, the historical answer has always been that you do it by increasing material living standards. But we've got to the end of that. I was looking at some data, American data recently. I don't know what proportion of people below the federal poverty line in the States you'd think had air conditioning. There's about 12.6% of the American population who come below the federal poverty line. What proportion of them do you think have any kind of air conditioning? Any guesses? Don't expect so. 80%. About a third of them have more than one car. And the levels of living in the affluent societies are quite extraordinary. Only about 10% of the American poor live in trailer homes. Something like 40% of them own their own homes. And I'm not making light of poverty. Relative poverty has, as I will be showing you, extremely serious consequences. But we have to recognize that it's relative. It's where you are in relation to other people. It's not a relation between people and things that counts, between us and material goods and our material circumstances. It's the relationship between people that matters, as structured by the material inequalities. Now, if you look at income and health within countries, you get these extraordinary regular gradients. These are the health inequalities. This is American data. These are the average income of zip code areas, the poor here and the rich out there. And as you look from poorer to richer zip code areas, death rates come tumbling down. These red dots are countries, the rich developed countries. And within each of them is a gradient like this. So income means something very important within societies, which it doesn't mean between them. It doesn't matter whether I think there's a difference, a sort of twofold difference in living standards between the richer and poorer countries there, with no consequences for average life expectancy. So within societies, we're dealing with relative income or social position, something like that. Now, I said after finding that physical health was better in more egalitarian countries, population levels of population health are better, I've been looking at other social problems that, like ill health, also have social gradients, where you expect worse outcomes in the more deprived areas of the cities and that kind of thing. We've now gone found internationally comparable data on physical health, mental health, homicide rates, drug abuse, obesity, how much people feel they can trust others, teenage birth rates, children's educational performance, measured by these international maths and literacy tests, measures of child well-being, the UNICEF measures, social mobility, and imprisonment rates. All of them are significantly related to income distribution amongst the rich developed countries. And also, we use two test beds. We look at it internationally. If we take the 20, 25 richest countries, do the more unequal ones have worse outcomes on all these things? And we also look at it amongst the 50 American states as a separate test bed. The only one where we find relationships internationally, but not among the 50 states, is mental health. We find relationships with child mental health in the United States, i.e. the more unequal states have worse child mental health, but no relationships with adult mental health. And I think that's because on many forms of mental illness in the States, there are not the expected social gradients. I don't know why that is. I haven't yet had time to investigate it. I'm going to show you some of these relationships between income inequality and homicides and so on, just to give you a flavor of the data. I haven't got time to go through it all. This I put first because it's mental health. These are the WHO measures of mental illness. They have two measures. There's the prevalence of any mental illness and the prevalence of serious mental illness. They're both strongly related to income inequality. This is a measure of income inequality I'll use in a lot of the graphs. It's how much richer are the richest 20% than the poorest 20%. So the richest 20% is 8 times as rich as the poorest, and there they're only 4 times as rich. And you see there's this remarkable gradient up here. Singapore appears as an outlier. In these WHO figures on mental illness are included addictions. And in Singapore, it's a capital offence to use some drugs, and so addictions are excluded. Otherwise, Singapore would be up there somewhere. Now, I want to show you in a number of these the scale of differences we're talking about. You know, down here we've got, about 5% of the population with any mental illness, and up there we've got 25%. Fivefold differences in the prevalence of mental illness across the whole population, strongly related to income inequality. This is the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing. You remember Britain came bottom. It was a major news item a few months ago. There's Britain down there. Same measure of income inequality. The index of child well-being has about 40 different components. And the Scandinavian countries up there. Did I miss one out? No, I didn't. Infant mortality rates, same sort of picture. Significant relationships. All these relationships are statistically significant, and in the States as well as among the 50 states, as well as amongst this group of rich developed countries. Can you see roughly what countries there are in the back, or should I read them through? I see someone shaking their head. Well, here we've got USA, Portugal, New Zealand, UK, Ireland, Israel, Greece, Australia, Italy, Spain, Germany, France, Netherlands, Austria, Switzerland, Belgium, Denmark, Canada, Norway, Finland, Japan, and Sweden. So, rich, developed market democracies. And one of the things I want to emphasize, because, you know, as a shorthand, I talk about equal and unequal societies, We're not talking about any utopian equality. All that I'm talking about is about the differences in the amount of inequality between different rich, developed market democracies or American states. Nothing unobtainable at all. This is male death rates, working-aged men. These greenish dots are American states and Canadian provinces down here. This is from a paper in the British Medical Journal, and this is the more equal end. In all my other graphs, the more equal end is here, and that's the more unequal. But this one, the Canadian provinces are more equal and have lower death rates, but striking relationships. Same relationships exist, but not as tight a fit for women. They don't seem to, they're pretty weak if you look at old people's death rates. They're strong for infant mortality and so on. This is obesity. This is women's obesity. It's significant relationship with inequality for men and women. But I think because women, the social gradient in women's obesity is stronger than the social gradient in men's obesity, the relationship with inequality is slightly stronger for women than men. But again, huge differences. We've got, 5% of the population obese there and over 30% up here. I can't remember, did I? Yeah, okay. Homicide rates. These are American states and Canadian provinces. And that's the more unequal end with higher homicide rates. Huge differences again. That's about 15 homicides per million people, and up there 150. Tenfold differences. I think, you know, we're not aware of how big these differences are. And we're talking not about small risk groups within the population. We're not talking about just the poor. These effects are much too big to be just the poor. We're talking about something going on across the whole society, and I'll come back to that later. This is prison populations. Again, going from, I don't know, about 40 prisoners per 100,000 population to 400. I may say that these relationships are not due primarily to, the increase in prison population in Britain and the States is not due primarily to a rise in crime. In the States, that accounts for about 20% of the rise in prison populations, but 80% of it seems to be more punitive sentencing. And there's also a tendency for the more unequal states to be the ones that retain the death penalty in the States. So, you know, I don't know whether it's a greater fear of people, each other, across the sort of class divide in more unequal societies. This is data on drug taking. We got separate figures from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime on opiates, cocaine, cannabis, ecstasy, and amphetamines, and we put them, we got the Z score for each of these, and so it's an average Z score of all these different substances. Now, as a sort of summary of what I've told you so far, we've put all those health and social problems listed here, life expectancy, maths and literacy scores that I haven't shown you, the international maths and literacy scores of young people, infant mortality, homicide rates, imprisonment rate, teenage birth rates, levels of trust that I haven't shown you. Again, there's sort of three, fourfold differences in levels of trust between people in more and less equal societies, obesity, mental illness, and social mobility. Again, Z scores of each of these things, so you get an average score for each country. And there's its relationship with inequality. Now, I think it's very hard to explain these relationships any other way. First, that's what the relationship looks like if you put GDP per capita across the bottom instead of inequality. There's no significant relationship. We find just the same pattern in the US. Health and social problems seem to be related to inequality and not to how rich a particular state is. But to go back to this one, people used to say maybe it's the English-speaking countries that do badly. The way they run their economies is different. And, you know, the UK is there and the USA is there, but Portugal is in the middle. Where we have data, Singapore is, except where they don't include addictions in their mental health, Singapore is right up there. And it's hard to think of more different countries than USA, Portugal, UK, Singapore. Totally different. If you look at the more equal end, you've got the Nordic countries, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, but you've also got Japan, which, you know, differs dramatically from the other ones. The position of women is extraordinarily different in Sweden and Japan. They're at opposite ends of the pole, really. And how they get their greater equality is also very different. Sweden does it through a massive welfare state and huge redistribution. In Japan, their equality comes from smaller differences in their earnings to start with, before taxes and benefits. And you see the same pattern in the United States. Most of the states that do well do have a lot of public expenditure and good services and so on, but there are some like New Hampshire which are completely the opposite, but they happen to be have more egalitarian wage differences to start with, and so they do well on all these outcomes. So it looks as if equality matters however you get there. And I don't think it's easy to explain these relationships away. And I occasionally ask people, can you think of any other explanation of that grouping of countries? And people, well, I don't know, it's been in the discussion, please say. The other thing to notice is that it's always the same group of countries that do well and always the same group that do badly. So we're looking at a sort of cross-the-board social dysfunction in more unequal societies. I think this also reflects on how we understand social gradients. We did do a sort of formal test to see whether the death rates with steeper social gradients are also more closely related to inequality, and that's true. So something like breast cancer, which doesn't have a social gradient, it's just as common amongst middle-class women as poorer women, is not related to inequality amongst the, certainly in the American states. But, you know, we often think of social gradients in so many different social problems as maybe it's society is a vast sort of mixing machine or sorting machine, and the vulnerable move down and the ones made of stronger stuff somehow move up. And so social gradients just reflect where people end up. People often think of it as a reflection of what poorer material conditions do to you. You know, relationships between damp housing and, well, nobody suggests it causes more heart disease or cancer, but perhaps more respiratory disease. You know, material factors being the important thing, direct effects of poorer material conditions. But, you know, that really doesn't explain why richer countries or richer American states don't do any better. It doesn't explain why the relationships are with inequality. But the suggestion that it's really about social position, social status, relative income, seems to be confirmed by these relationships with inequality. The easy way of understanding what I've said so far is that in more unequal countries, of course, you know, poor people are doing worse. And so it's just a result of having more poor people or something like that. That is not what's happening. It's really important to recognize that. I pointed out while showing you those things that the differences are too enormous between those societies to be explained in those terms. But when people compare different countries, you can see that more equal countries do better right across the board. So this is a graph using the international literacy scores, allowing you to compare kids in different countries. The kids are arranged here by how many years of education their parents have had. So here you've got the literacy scores of kids with well-educated parents nearer the top of society. And here you have the kids who've had, I say kids, but actually they're 16 to 25, of parents nearer the bottom of society. So these are the low-status kids and those are the high-status ones. And you can see that how well each country does overall is related to how steep its social gradient is. But you can also see that even if you're somewhere in the middle or well above the middle, you do better in a more equal country like Sweden than you do in Canada, than you do in USA. Sweden is the most equal, Canada, and then US the most unequal. And people used to say to me, why worry about inequality? What matters is improving overall standards. Inequalities is a side issue, but actually it's central to how you improve standards. This is work we did on health. I won't explain it in much detail except to say that these are the gradients between income and health in more equal states, and that is in the more unequal states. So you can see, even if you're on an income of, say, $40,000 a year, you do better if you're in a more equal state. So it's not a matter of maybe you'd have a lower income in a more unequal state. It's even if you're on the same income, you do better. These are rather old comparisons that people in Sweden made. These are social class differences, social classes 1 and 2, 3 non-manual, 3 manual, 4 and 5, the unskilled, semi and unskilled manual occupations. And here the death rates, I'm sorry, again of working aged men, I use the data that's around. These purple or mauve bars, no, what would you, purple, are the Swedish death rates at this time, and those are the ones in England and Wales. So if inequality is anything to do with why Sweden is healthier than Britain, it looks as if people benefit right across the spectrum. And so, you know, even their social classes 4 and 5 were doing better than our 1 and 2. If you look at infant mortality, exactly the same picture. The England and Wales ones and the Swedish ones in the more equal society. You know, they're not revolutionarily different in, you know, they still live in the same world as us. This is from a paper by Banks and Marmot. It came out a year ago in Journal of the American Medical Association, which compared health in England with USA, and it looked at prevalence of various illnesses. Well, it actually had lots of measures of health, including death rates and including biological measures like blood pressure and cholesterol levels and so on. But here is diabetes, hypertension, cancer, lung disease and heart disease. And in each case, they're shown for low, medium, and high educational groups. They also published figures showing them by income, and it looks just the same. But you see, even the highest educational group does better in Britain than, or England and Wales than in the States on each of these diseases. So, you know, the benefits, if the differences between countries are to do with the amount of inequality, the benefits seem widespread. And the differences between countries are so large in all the outcomes I've been showing you, that it cannot be explained just in terms of what's happening at the bottom of the spectrum. Can I take a few minutes just to say something about... And for me, this kind of data was very unexpected. There was a time when I became, you know, I thought maybe I'd got it all wrong, and I became afraid of looking at the data because I thought it would just prove me wrong more and more. I now feel quite the opposite, but I was afraid of it partly because it seemed so counterintuitive. That there should be such big differences and they should be related to something as simple as inequality. I suppose one thing I would say, though, and supposing you were studying different primates, non-human primates, various monkeys or apes or whatever, probably the first thing you'd want to know about social organization is how much of a dominance hierarchy there is, and so much is related to that. You might also want to know whether they pair bond or not, so that too seems to be perhaps related to inequality in the more species with dominance hierarchies. The dominant males tend to try and monopolize access to females, so these things do go together. But I mean, it is a very fundamental variable. I want, though, to say why I think we are sensitive to it as we are. Remember, I come at all this stuff not from psychology. I have no background there at all. I don't know any of the stuff that you people know. But in health, the most important psychosocial risk factors, which really seem powerful in explaining health inequalities, are low social status, weak social affiliations, almost any measure of how your involvement in social life or close confiding relationships or number of friends seems to be highly protective, and then stress in early life, including maternal stress in pregnancy, in terms of sort of ideas people are having about stress responses and being programmed by early experience. And I do think that maybe underlying those three, which, you know, if the social epidemiology is right, then those are the most important sources of chronic stress in modern societies. Because we know they work through the biological effects of chronic stress. But maybe they're all pointing to similar underlying social anxieties, in that the insecurities from early life may go with the insecurities that go associated with low social status. And friendship, you know, friends make you feel better about yourself, make you feel valued, rather than leaving you to worry about whether your people regard you as unattractive, stupid, you know, all those worries one can have. About how others see you. I think that maybe that's at the bottom of the social anxieties, the stresses of modern society that are shown in the social epidemiology by the prominence of variables of this kind as protective of health. When I first started thinking about that, I hadn't seen a paper which goes through vast numbers of experiments where volunteers have been invited into a laboratory, exposed to some experimental stressor, and then had their cortisol responses measured. So, you know, you make them do nasty problems, or you give them mild electric shocks, or nasty noises, or ask them to write about unpleasant experiences they've had, or make them self-conscious by videoing them, whatever it is. And two people went through all those studies to see what kinds of experimental stressors most reliably raise people's cortisol levels. And this is what they found. They found 208 studies of that kind. And The ones the stresses which most reliably raised cortisol levels were tasks that included social evaluative threat, such as threats to self-esteem or social status, in which others could negatively judge performance, particularly when the outcome of the performance was uncontrollable. Those provoked larger and more reliable cortisol changes than stresses without these threats. I think that fits in very well with the interpretation I move towards of why these things, you know, the underlying social anxieties that perhaps account for why those are so prominent. I think another indication that that is the right way of thinking about what's going on and why we are sensitive to stress is because apart from the relationships between physical health and inequality, where, you know, there have been now about 200 studies showing that physical health is worse where inequality is greater, the other well-researched relationship is between violence or homicide rates and inequality. There must be 30 or 40 papers looking at that relationship. And when you start trying to account for why violence is more common in more unequal societies, of course, it's not violence of the poor against the rich, it's violence amongst the poor. And it looks from lots of sources as if much the most important triggers to violence are people feeling looked down on, disrespected, humiliated. This is what a prison psychiatrist, someone who'd been working in prisons with violent men for 25 years, said. The inmates he'd worked with said when he asked them why they had assaulted someone that it was because he disrespected me or my visitor. And he goes as far as to say, you know, despite that enormous experience of talking daily to really violent men, he says, I have yet to see a serious act of violence that was not provoked by the experience of feeling shamed and humiliated, disrespected and ridiculed, and did not represent the attempt to prevent or undo this loss of face. And, you know, we're all, I think, familiar with that. But it suggests that what matters about being at the bottom of the heap is how you're seen. And, you know, goods matter because if you've got second-class goods, you're a second-class person. Increasingly, that's, you know, why they matter in modern societies. You're also, I think, familiar with many psychological experiments where artificial distinctions have been set up between people and you find out how being inferior, an artificial creation of an inferior status, affects performance amongst school children and so on. This is an experiment reported in one of the World Bank's World Development Reports where children from different Indian castes are asked to do mazes, you know, where you find your way into the center without crossing one of the lines. And when these are high caste and those are low caste children, and when they don't know each other's caste, they perform equally well. When they do know each other's caste, because they've had to say which village they come from, what their father's occupation is, and what their surname is, suddenly the low-caste kids do less well. And there are experiments with which involve triggering sort of stigma associated with ethnicity and things like that, and exactly the same effect. So we know how sensitive we are in from work of that kind. But I think in a way the most familiar experience of this is what Alan Bennett describes in his parents. Remember, Alan Bennett went to Cambridge. His parents had a butcher's shop in Bradford. He says his parents put down most of their imagined shortcomings to not having been educated. Education was to them a passport to everything they lacked: self-confidence, social ease, and above all, the ability to be like other people. Put simply, and as they themselves would have put it, both my parents were shy, a shortcoming they thought of as an affliction, while at the same time enshrining it as a virtue. I assured them falsely that everybody felt much as they did, but the social ease was something that could and should be faked. Well, you can do that, Dad would say. You've been educated, adding how often he felt that he had nothing to contribute. I'm boring, I think. I can't understand why anybody likes us. I wonder sometimes whether they do, really. And you see, in a way, I think there are perhaps two responses to inferior status. You either accept your inferiority, as seems to be happening here, or you fight against it. The violence response that we were talking about a moment ago. I've got 5 minutes. Okay. Social status and friendship come up again and again in the health literature. Friendship highly protective of health, almost whatever measure you use. Social status, low social status, or increased status differentials on a societal level, harmful to health. They move inversely in societies. I could have shown you graphs showing that as inequality increases, as status differentials increase, levels of trust go down. Involvement in community life goes down. The Putnam measures of social capital are related to inequality, and violence, as I showed you, is related to inequality. So the quality of social relations moves inversely. Now, I think one has to ask, why is social status and friendship apparently constantly linked, both at the individual level, you know, how they relate to my own health or your health, and at the societal level? And the answer, I think, is simply that they are quite different social relationships. They're the opposite social relationships. It's social status. If you think about animal dominance hierarchies or pecking orders, their ordering is based on power, on coercion, on privileged access to resources, regardless of others' needs. You know, this is the sort of free-for-all, concrete jungle kind of thing. Whereas friendship is exactly the opposite of that. These are the two opposite ways in which people can associate. Friendship is about gift exchange, about reciprocity, mutuality, social obligations, a recognition of each other's needs. And of course, the most fearsome rivals for almost any creature are members of the same species, because they have all the same needs. I mean, even if you look at, I don't know, birds on a bird feeder, the fights are not between different species. The fights are between the same species. What the low-status baboon has to watch out for is not so much lions as high-status baboons. I think that we are incredibly attentive to social status issues and to friendship issues because they have been crucial to our welfare throughout our evolution. And that perhaps really explains what's going on. Now, what I think, you know, in terms of what inequality does to a society, I said this already in bits and pieces. Bigger status differences mean that status becomes obviously more important. So status competition increases. There are more insecurities about appearances and how we're seen. You know, if some people count for everything and others count for nothing, then where do people think you fit in? It's really important. Whereas if you feel we're all accepted as sort of fellow human beings, roughly equally, you don't have to worry so much. And you see these problems. I think of school kids and the conformity or the need to have the right indicators of status, the labels, the right kind of bags, and the power of peer groups. And think also of the levels of self-harm, particularly amongst teenage girls. More discrimination against vulnerable minorities and women. I think that increased material differences will become overlaid with all the markers of status differentiation. All the way Bourdieu says that we use our taste in books, films, music, clothes, art, whatever, food, to reflect social status, to indicate social status, and that we maintain our position partly by showing our superiority, our prejudices, and stigmatization of those below us. And there have been papers in the States that suggest that ethnic minorities and women particularly suffer. And of course, humiliated men are more likely to be violent against women. I mean, this is the sort of, you know, the captain kicks the cabin boy and the cabin boy kicks the cat kind of downward, taking it out on ones below you. So I think that's basically what's been going on. And my last two slides, what's been happening to inequality. This goes from 1979 until 2005 to 6. That's the rise in inequality under Thatcher, and then the sort of vaguely up and down little wiggles under Major and then Blair. Labour have redistributed, so things would be worse, they'd be up here somewhere if Brown's budgets hadn't been redistributionary. But there has been an underlying widening of differences in earnings, you know, these huge profits people have been taking and, at the top. And so basically, we still have the levels of inequality that were created during the Thatcher period, and I think we're seeing the social results of those now all around us. And this is my last slide. When people talk about getting rid of or revising death duties or inheritance tax, I think one of the reasons why we feel a more egalitarian society than early in last century is because actually there has been a huge redistribution of wealth. The richest 1% in 1910 owned 70% of all wealth. It fell to, 18% around there. It's now more like 23%. But enormous amount of wealth was redistributed, mainly to the top, the next 10% of the population. But, you know, this is, I suppose, some of the big estates being broken up by death duties, and it must be part of why we feel a more egalitarian, less class-bound society than we were 100 years ago. And I think it's really important to remember these kinds of drivers. This is fairly typical of what's gone on in a number of developed countries. So I do think this is about material factors, both in terms of income and wealth. These are, if you like, the material foundations of the quality of social relationships in our societies. And if we're going to improve the real quality of life in modern societies, it's the social environment we have to think about. And actually, I feel very optimistic seeing this kind of data, because what it means is suddenly we have a way, perhaps, of tackling the psychosocial well-being of whole populations through fairly crude policy instruments. Okay, thanks.